Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 303 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In this podcast, I'm going to be finishing up our discussion of diabetes, and then we'll be done with this. This should be a relatively short one. So, again, we've talked about diabetes. We've talked about the different types. We've talked about different pathways. We've talked about different physiologies. We've talked about different microassociations, renal associations, fluid dynamics associations, right? Again, I'll encourage you, really listen to part one and two. Again, you'll learn so much from those podcasts. Again, I know they're called diabetes podcasts, but they discuss a lot more than diabetes, right? So one thing I just want to say, though, is that you should keep in mind is, let's just get right to it, right? So again, today is just to kind of clean up what I've discussed in the first two podcasts, although they will for the most part be new information. So, first thing I want to say is, what is this antihypertensive that we try to avoid in people that have diabetes? Well, I would hope you're telling me beta blockers, right? Beta blockers, they're not necessarily the best for a person that has diabetes, right? Because if you think about it, beta blockers, they can blunt the neuroglycopenic symptoms you can get with diabetes, right? So if a person is a diabetic, right, and let's say they become hypoglycemic, right, for many reasons, you know, it can be because they either took a ton of insulin or they took insulin and then they worked out, right? Maybe when they should have taken a smaller dose of insulin. Or let's say it's a type 2 diabetic, right, that took a sulfonylurea, right, or took amiglutinide, like repaglinide and atelglinide. Remember, those things have a very strong association with hypoglycemia, right? So they took those things, and then you notice that, oh, wow, they were exercising, and then they passed out, right? That's going to be, like hypoglycemia that made them pass out, right? But again, usually when a person's glucose is running low, I mean, think about if you fast for a couple of hours or you've not eaten for a couple of hours, you'll be sweating, you'll be tremulous, everything. Those are adrenergic symptoms, right? I mean, those are essentially your counter-regulatory hormones, like epinephrine, for example, saying, okay, guys, we got to get some food in here, right? Because remember, epinephrine is one of those counter-regulatory hormones. It works through a G-protein coupled receptor, actually a stimulatory G-protein coupled receptor like epinephrine, right? So beta blockers, they blunt those responses, right? Because they block your ability to respond to that epinephrine. So that's why, again, beta blockers are not great for diabetics. And to be honest with you, that's not all. Another reason why beta blockers are not great for diabetics is because they actually are associated with a worsening. Beta blockers are just not great for people that have insulin-related problems, so glucose-related problems, right? They're not necessarily the best in those circumstances. And then one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is what kind of hyponatremia is found in people let's say they are going through like a diabetic emergency. But I really hope you're telling me that, oh, wow, Divine, these people tend to have like a false hyponatremia. In fact, sometimes it's called a hyper or smaller hyponatremia, right? Hyper or smaller hyponatremia. Hyper or smaller hyponatremia, right? So why is that the case? Well, we know that the equation for serum osmolarity is 2 times your sodium, right, plus your glucose over 18 plus your BUN over 2.8. That's the formula. Now, the thing is, when a person has normal blood glucose, right, glucose over 18, normal blood glucose is, you know, between 90 to 100. So let's just say 90 to make the numbers work well, right? 90 divided by 18 is 5. Well, 2 times your sodium. Your sodium is usually around 135. That's like 270. So if you notice, the amount being contributed on the normal blood glucose standards is very negligible, right? It's not a big deal. But let's say a person goes into a DKA or HHNS and their blood glucose becomes like 1,000. Well, 1,000 divided by 18, if I'm doing my math correctly, is just under 96. No, oh, come on, Divine, that's terrible. It's just under 56, right? It's just under 56. Sorry about my bad math there. Just under 56. That definitely becomes a big contributor at that time, right? So in that case, when a person is in DKA or HHNS, their blood glucose goes up, right? So their serum osmolarity, if you calculate it, again, using that formula I described, it will go up. So those people's serum osmolality goes up, and then they have hyponatremia. But is it a real hyponatremia? Not really, right? Because again, remember, when you have that buildup of glucose in your bloodstream, That's going to pull water out of your cells, right? And again, if you remember from general chemistry in college, right? Concentration is mass divided by volume. If the mass of sodium in your body is staying constant, but the volume of your bloodstream, you know, which is essentially like the solvent for the sodium, is going up, then you're basically diluting that sodium, right? Sometimes people call it a dilutional hyponatremia. And again, on NBM exams, it's actually high yield to know how to do the correction, right? So let me just run you through an example here. So let's say a person's blood glucose is 1,000, right? And you're like, wow, this person's sodium is 120, according to my measurements, right? Should you freak out? No, you should not, right? Because if I let's use a blood glucose of 1,000. Why not, right? So excuse me. So the way you do the math is you basically subtract the 100 from the total blood glucose, right? So total blood glucose is 1,000. If you subtract the 100, you're left with 900, right? 900 is literally 9 times 100. At least this is the way I do it. So 900 is literally 9 times 100, right? So it's like there's 9 hundredths in 900. So you just take that 9 and multiply by 1.6. And if I'm doing my math well, so 9 multiplied by 1.6, I know that 1.6 times 10 is 16. So if we dock 1.6 from that, that should put us right at 14.4. So that correction of 14.4, go ahead and add it to the original sodium that you measured, 120. So the sodium is roughly 134.4, right? So if you round it down, you know, because it's less than 0.5, you get 134, right? So that's the corrected sodium, which is obviously normal, right? Now remember, when people are also in these diabetic emergencies, especially in DKA, they do have hyperkalemia, right? You know, you can see their blood glucose. I mean, you see their blood potassium concentration. Oh, wow. You're like, wow, this is so bad, right? They have hyperkalemia. But the thing is, their total body potassium is actually low. So what actually causes that hyperkalemia? Well, again, say, for example, if you're in DKA, your blood is very acidic, right? If your blood is very acidic, your body will say, okay, you know what? Let's try to put some of those hydrogen ions inside the cell, right? But again, to maintain electron neutrality, as those hydrogen ions are entering the cell, potassium will come out in reverse, right? Potassium will come out in reverse. And when potassium comes out in reverse, right, you have hyperkalemia. That's one. Second thing is, when a person is in DKA or HHNS, they're not getting any insulin effect, right? And remember that one of the jobs of insulin is that it increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. Well, if your sodium potassium ATPase pump is not working, right, you're not going to be bringing sodium out of the cell, but more importantly, you're not going to be putting potassium into the cell. So potassium will hang out extracellularly, right? So that will also cause hyperkalemia, right? That will also cause hyperkalemia. But that high level of potassium in their bloodstream is actually also leaving by osmotic diuresis. Again, high glucose in your urine, it will draw water. It also draws that potassium along for the ride. So this is just one of these high yield things to keep in mind, right? So in general, how do we treat these diabetic emergencies, right? DKA, HHNS, doesn't matter. What do you do? Well, your first step on an NBM exam is always to give fluids, right? Always give fluids, right? Again, those people can be, they're very volume depleted. And the fluid you give them, just give them normal saline, right? Again, I know for whatever bizarre reason, med students tend to get very caught up in, oh, should I give lactated ringers? Should I give, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But for the most part, I'll say like, almost like 99% of the time, the right fluid to give to people on NBM exams is normal saline. There's, you know, weird exception to that though. If a person has just had like a large volume paracentesis, or they're like an end-stage liver disease patient, right? But usually it will be an end-stage liver disease patient in the setting of large volume paracentesis. You know, sometimes in a large volume paracentesis, you can pull up to 10 liters of fluid from someone. I've definitely seen that happen. In that case, right, if you want to maintain, because those fluid shifts, right, can cause, you know, profound hypotension, kidney failure and stuff like that, which you don't, obviously don't want. So the way you can kind of, you know, try to prevent that is you can give albumin, right? Give albumin, because people that have liver disease, and let's say they've gone through this large volume paracentesis, right? If you just give them straight up normal saline, these people, their livers don't work. So guess what? They are not making protein. So the oncotic pressures are in the toilet, very, very low, right? So for these people, if you give them fluids, because there's no protein to hold it in the vascular tree, they will just literally extravasate all this fluid and they'll have more and more edema. So if you want to actually keep the fluid in your vascular tree, you give them fluid that has protein in it. Sometimes they call this fluid colloid, but basically it's albumin. You give that, it will jack up the oncotic pressures in their bloodstream. It will keep water in the bloodstream, right? And then those people will be fine. So just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, the thing is, so I said if you're treating DKA, HHNS, right, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to give fluids. In this case, that fluid is going to be normal saline, right? So you're going to give normal saline. And don't forget, right, again, they can even give you a shock question on pressing DKA or HHNS. Again, because these people are profoundly volume depleted, right, these people have a kind of hypovolemic shock, right? So if a person has hypovolemic shock, what's true of their preload? Well, I hope you tell me that their preload is low, right? So if their preload is low, their cardiac output is also going to be low because there's literally like no gas in the tank. If you're not sending blood to the heart, I don't know, the heart cannot just conjure blood from nowhere, right? So their preload is going to be low. Their cardiac output is going to be low, right? And so their preload is going to be low. Their cardiac output is going to be low, right? And again, because there's just no gas in the tank, their right atrial pressure, which is your central venous pressure, their left atrial pressure, which is your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, those will both be low, right? And again, because their blood pressure is really low, the body is like, okay, let's try to see if we can, you know, maintain pressures, at least perfusion of the vital organs, right? So they will have an increase in their systemic vascular resistance, right? So again, basically those values for hypovolemic shock will obtain in a person that has DKA or HHNS, right? So you, again, you give normal saline first, right? And then the other thing you give is insulin. And again, the insulin you give is insulin regular, right? Remember, that's the only insulin that is capable of being given IV. I believe I talked about that in episode 301, right? So just something to keep at the back of your mind for on exams, right? And then you also need to pay attention to these people's potassiums, right? So I know that people always review these complex algorithms and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, oh no, what do I do? What do I do, Divine? How do I memorize this, right? Especially for those taking step 2 CK, step 3. Basically, let me teach you an easy trick. Just remember the range 3.3 to 5.5. That's it. 3.3 to 5.5, right? So if you're treating a person that's in DKA or HHNS and you notice that, oh, wow, their potassium is more than 5.5, well, what are you supposed to do? You don't need to add any potassium to the fluids that they're getting. You know, those people probably have adequate amounts of potassium to kind of tidy them over. Now, if they're within the range, so if they are more than, so notice it's a range, 3.3 to 5.5. If you're more than 5.5, you don't need to add potassium to the fluids. If you're between 3.3 and 5.5, you do need to add potassium to the fluids you're giving them, right? But if their potassium is less than 3.3 at baseline, you want to give them insulin, that's not a good idea, right? In fact, if a person is being treated for DKA, HHNS, and their potassium ends up being less than 3.3, you need to go ahead and stop the insulin infusion. You may be like, Divine, why? Well, let me explain. The reason you stop that insulin infusion is, again, remember one of the things I said. One of the jobs of insulin is that it increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So if that pump starts working great in a person that already has hypokalemia, you're going to be driving more and more potassium into cells. That's going to even worsen person's hypokalemia and they can die. So you obviously don't want that, right? You obviously don't want that. So if your K is more than 5.5, you don't need to add potassium to the fluids and insulin they're getting. If their K is within range 3.3 to 5.5, right, you need to add potassium to the fluid and insulin they're getting. If their K is less than 3.3, you need to stop the insulin infusion. Keep giving them fluids, but stop the insulin infusion. Replenish their potassium. When it gets above 3.3 again, you know, maybe a few points above that, you can then start giving them insulin again. So it's a high yield thing to know, right? And then what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, is being treated for DKA, HHNS, and, you know, the person gets an arrhythmia and dies or something, and you don't see hypokalemia as an answer, what should you go with? Especially these people that, you know, they got very large amounts of insulin. What should you go with? Like, again, bad arrhythmia and they die. I would hope you, and you're asking for an electrolyte abnormality. I would really hope you're thinking about hypophosphatemia, right? I would really hope you're thinking about hypophosphatemia. To be honest with you, essentially the thing that killed this person is a modified form of refeeding syndrome, right? You'd be like, really? Well, let me explain. Refeeding syndrome is something we classically find in anorexics, right? You know, people that have eating disorders, they've not eaten for a long time, right? And then you start feeding them. That's why you're supposed to feed them slowly and steadily, right? If you feed them quickly, the body will be like, okay, I haven't seen food for a long time. Let's go ahead and make a ton of insulin so that, because your cells, they'll be like, wow, we haven't seen food. I mean, think about it. If you fasted for like 7-8 days straight, right? You're really hungry at the end. Anything that's placed before you, you eat it with gusto, right? You grab that thing, you eat it big time, right? That's the exact same thing that happens to your cells, right? When they've not seen food for a while, right? They're like, oh, we gotta eat. And again, what is the hormone that helps your cells eat? It's literally insulin. Just think of insulin as the fast food for your body, right? It makes them take up that glucose, right? So whenever a person starts refeeding after a long fast, there is hyperinsulinemia. You release a ton of insulin. That insulin you release a ton of will drive things into cells. Just think of insulin as something that drives things into cells, drives glucose into cells, drives amino acids into cells, drives potassium into cells through the sodium potassium ATPase pump, drives phosphate into cells, right? So that phosphate can be driven into cells so hard that the person gets hypophosphatemia. You may be like, Divine, why do I care about this hypophosphatemia? Well, hypophosphatemia will make it hard for ATP to be available to the heart, and the person can get an arrhythmia and die. In fact, let me tell you this, this is very high yield. The most common cause of death in patients that are undergoing refeeding, that are going through refeeding syndrome is hypophosphatemia, right? Low phosphate is the most common cause of death in people that have a refeeding syndrome, right? So the thing is, when a person has diabetes, right, and they're in DKA, HHNS, they have this massive hyperglycemia, right? But your cells are literally not, it's like you have food in your presence, but your hands are tied. You can't touch it because you don't have insulin to help you take up that food, right? So when these people start getting insulin, right, they will start driving things into cells, right? So again, their potassium can go down precipitously, cause hypokalemia. But their phosphate can also go down precipitously and cause hypophosphatemia, right? So that's something you actually want to keep at the back of your mind. In fact, if you're managing patients that have DKA, HHNS, you better watch their potassium, you better watch their phosphate, right? So you don't get burned. So how do people, to be honest with you, right, like if they give you a question about a person that has an elevated creatinine, right, and they're in DKA, HHNS, what should you be thinking about as the cause of the elevated creatinine? I really hope you're telling me that, oh, these people probably have like an acute kidney injury, right? Some kind of prerenal AKI, right? Why is it a prerenal AKI? Again, these people are volume down, right? So again, I would hope you're telling me that, oh, wow, their BUN to creatinine will be greater than 20, right? Again, remember the BUN rises faster than the creatinine for many reasons, because when your volume down, your ADH goes up. And ADH does not just help you reabsorb water. ADH also helps you reabsorb urea, right? That's one thing that you don't see many resources, but it's actually true. So as your urea is being reabsorbed at an accelerated clip, right, your BUN will rise faster than your creatinine. So your BUN to creatinine ratio will be more than 20, right? And obviously your urine sodium will be low as well, because you're trying to keep as much of it as possible, right? And your fractional excretion of sodium, again, will be less than, you know, usually 2% or thereabouts, right? And your urine osmolarity will be really high, right? Because again, you're trying to keep as much water as is humanly possible, although having a ton of glucose in the lumen of your nephrons makes that a little difficult. So a few quick topics I just want to discuss here, right? So how do we diagnose diabetes? Well, we actually diagnose diabetes in multiple ways, right? So one way is if a person comes in with the classic signs of hyperglycemia, you know, polydipsia, polyuria, polyphagia, right? You have the classic symptoms, and you just measure their glucose, right? Random non-fasting glucose. If it's more than or equal to 200, right, milligrams per deciliter, they have diabetes, right? So if a person's glucose is 200, they have diabetes if they present with these signs, right? So that's one diagnostic criteria. Another classic one is fasting, right? So the fasting plasma glucose, if it is greater than or equal to 126, so again, 126, the number is included, right? So fasting, what do I mean by fasting? It means you're basically not eating for 8 hours. That's how it's defined in the world of medicine, right? And then another classic diagnostic test you can use is you can do the hemoglobin A1C, right? If your hemoglobin A1C is more than 6.5%, so more than or equal to 6.5%, so 6.5% is included, it means the person has a diabetes, right? And then another thing you can also do is you can do the oral glucose tolerance test, right? So the oral glucose tolerance test, essentially, you give the person like a 75 gram glucose load, right? Give them that 75 gram glucose load, and then you check their glucose 2 hours, their blood glucose 2 hours later. If their blood glucose is greater than or equal to 200 milligrams per deciliter, they do have diabetes, right? They do have diabetes. So again, 200, the number is included. And to be honest with you, of all these, because again, this can be an MME question, of all these diagnostic whatever tests, the most sensitive one is actually the oral glucose tolerance test, right? It's used in research purposes and things of that nature. And again, remember, if that hemoglobin A1C, I kind of made this integration, I believe, yesterday in episode 302. But that hemoglobin A1C, again, is not going to be the best test. You should basically not select it in a person that has like some kind of red blood cell disorder, right? Like hereditary spherocytosis. If your red blood cells are dying at an accelerated clip, you may get a falsely depressed hemoglobin A1C, right? Because remember, again, hemoglobin A1C is literally something you measure based, it's kind of like a red blood cell based measure, right? So again, if a person has like sickle cell disease, or they have hereditary spherocytosis, or hereditary elliptocytosis, or some kind of autoimmune hemolytic anemia, measuring their hemoglobin A1C, it's maybe not the smartest idea in the world. I mean, it certainly will not be a smart idea on an MBME exam, right? So, and one thing I want to say is that to make these diagnoses of diabetes, these tests, you actually need to repeat them on a subsequent day, right? So basically, like, you can't make the diagnosis of diabetes by just doing these tests once. No. You got to do them twice, right? To confirm the diagnosis of diabetes. Again, because when you do a test twice, right, you're almost like increasing the sensitivity and specificity in a sense, right? Because, you know, if you do it once, you may just be catching the person at the wrong end of the spectrum, or just something weird is happening in their lives. They are very stressed, so their counter-regulatory hormones are really high. So because of that, their blood glucose is transiently high and stuff like that, right? So, I mean, many med students, they are definitely stressed. I can tell you that, especially right before March week or right before they take these USMLE exams, right? So that's why you have to essentially do two measurements with the same, you know, criteria. If it bears out positive on both, then the person does have diabetes. Now, one thing I want to say is that you want to keep in mind is, you know, not just diabetes, but something that previously back in the day we used to call pre-diabetes. In fact, these days, I believe it's called like impaired glucose tolerance, right? So you do need to know the numbers that go with those, right? Especially for these different diagnostic tests I've talked about, right? So we say that a fasting plasma glucose of greater than or equal to 126 mg per deciliter means person has diabetes. Well, the thing is, if you're between like roughly 110 to 125 with your fasting plasma glucose, that's something called impaired glucose tolerance. The oral glucose tolerance test, right? I said that, if for diabetes, we say that, 75 gram glucose low, 2 hours later, you check their blood glucose. If it's greater than or equal to 200 mg per deciliter, right, the person has diabetes. Well, if you check it 2 hours later and you notice that, oh, wow, it's between 140 and 199, right? So 199 is included, right? Then the person has impaired glucose tolerance. And then for the A1C criteria, if a person's hemoglobin A1C is between 5.7 and 6.4%, then those people, you know, they also have impaired glucose tolerance, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then one other thing on MBME exams they love to talk about with diabetes is they love to talk about this whole concept of gestational diabetes, right? And gestational diabetes is something I believe, some of you remember me talking about. I believe it was either episode 301 or episode 302. And I believed for that, I talked about, human placental lactogen. It's a diabetogenic hormone, right? And it causes insulin resistance, right? And again, obviously, that's going to be a good thing for baby because you don't want baby to starve, right? You want baby to have enough glucose to be able to feed. So that's why human placental lactogen is released, right? But again, many people that have gestational diabetes, they actually have a glucokinase mutations. It's just one of these weird weird association that your friends at the MBMEs, they kind of expect you to know, right? So just keep that at the back of your mind if I were you. If they ask for like the mechanism behind people getting gestational diabetes, if you don't see human placental lactogen as an answer, I would strongly encourage you to actually pick the answer that says that they have a glucokinase mutation, right? Now, one thing I want to say so that I don't forget, between DKA and HHNS that many people screw up is this whole concept of, because I know many med schools in the country, in fact, many resources, they teach that, you know, if your blood glucose is above a certain number, you're in HHNS. If your blood glucose is less than a certain number, is DKA. So, like, I think some people use 400, some use 500. Some people say, oh, if your blood glucose is more than 600, you're in HHNS, not DKA. I'll tell you this right now. That's an awful thing to do clinically and an awful thing to do on exams, right? On MBMEs, at least, since I'm not talking about clinical care in this podcast, on MBME exams, if a person has diabetes, right, it literally doesn't matter what their glucose is. If they're in a diabetic emergency, it literally doesn't matter what their glucose is. The thing that tells you the correct diagnosis on an MBME exam is what their bicarb is. If their bicarb is low, they have DKA. If their bicarb is roughly normal or normal, they have HHNS. So a person can have a glucose of 300 and be in HHNS on MBME exams, right? Again, look at the bicarb. If a person's glucose is 1,000 and their bicarb is 10, they're in DKA. Don't matter what their glucose is. If a person's glucose is 250 and their bicarb is 23 or 22, those people are in HHNS. Just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. Again, obviously, they're going to be exhibiting those symptoms of being in a diabetic crisis. Again, this stuff, very, very high yield to know for exams, right? So let's go back to gestational diabetes, right? So gestational diabetes, how do we screen for it, right? So we usually screen right around 24 weeks on MBME exams, right? Usually between 24 and 28 weeks, right? And for the most part, the thing you do is you give a 50 gram. And again, to be honest with you, these numbers, they're not particularly high yield to know for exams. I'll just see them for completeness sake, because I know some people listening to this podcast, they kind of like details. But, you know, give the, and actually many times I like to emphasize details. But again, the vast majority of the details I highlight are very high yield. This one particularly, though, I'll say is probably not high yield to know, right? So 50 grams of, they get 50 grams of glucose, and then you check their glucose level an hour later, right? If their glucose level is more than 140, right, it constitutes a positive screen, right? And if the person's screen is positive, then you follow it up with like a 3-hour glucose measure, right? You do a 3-hour glucose tolerance test. But again, that's kind of like a different thing. Again, I don't think these numbers are particularly important, so I'm just going to skip that, right? So the thing is, why are they so strict? Because again, you know, why are people so strict in like, oh, let's diagnose a gestational diabetes? The reason you make the diagnosis early is because it can have deleterious effects on the baby, right? The thing is, many times, right, when a woman has a lot of glucose in her bloodstream, right, when she has gestational diabetes, the baby is the one that's going to, I mean, she's going to have some problems, but the baby is also going to have a lot of problems, right? First things first, she's going to have problems with delivery, right? In fact, there's an increased rate of C-sections, right? Again, that can be an easy question they can throw on an MBME exam. There's an increased rate of C-sections in infants of diabetic moms, right? Because again, those kids are huge. Those kids are like 10 pounders, 11 pounders, right? Those kids have microsomia. So you may be like, okay, Divine, why do they have microsomia? Again, the thing is, one thing many people don't understand is that insulin literally is a growth factor, right? Insulin literally is a growth factor. In fact, insulin sort of kind of acts like growth hormone. I mean, think about it. Growth hormone, right? After growth hormone is released, what does it do? It increases your production of IGF-1. Well, what do you think IGF-1 stands for? Insulin-like growth factor 1, right? Insulin-like growth factor 1. So the thing is, insulin is a growth factor. In fact, insulin uses a tyrosine kinase, right? Insulin uses a tyrosine kinase. If I'm not mistaken, insulin uses a receptor tyrosine kinase, right? Again, remember, receptor tyrosine kinase is different from a non-receptor tyrosine kinase. Although, to be honest with you, that non-receptor tyrosine kinase term is almost like a misnomer, because there's an actual receptor involved. It's just not a tyrosine kinase. It's just a receptor that is associated with a tyrosine kinase. I believe that's something that you see like for prolactin, for example. But again, that's not the goal of this podcast, so I'm going to keep going. But again, the thing is, I want to establish the fact that insulin is a growth factor, right? So Insulin, again, it increases fatty acid synthesis, right? It increases fatty acid synthesis. Remember, insulin increases the activity of acetyl-CoA carboxylase. That's one. It increases the activity of fatty acid synthase. Believe it or not, that's an enzyme. It increases the activity of lipoprotein lipase, right? So that you can break down the triglycerides that exist in the bloodstream into monoacylglycerol and 2-free fatty acids and can get them into the adipocyte and then remake the triglyceride, right? So the thing is, insulin increases the fat that is stored in the baby's adipose tissue. Insulin, again, like I said, it drives things into cells. It also drives amino acid into muscle, right? So the thing is, insulin definitely makes the baby bigger, right? So it causes macrosomia, right? Insulin absolutely causes macrosomia, right? So the baby is big. And another thing that insulin causes, right, is respiratory distress syndrome, right? So we know that the biggest risk factor for respiratory distress syndrome on NBM exams is being born prematurely, right? But if you see respiratory distress syndrome in a term kid, right, in a term unit, I really want you to think about that unit being an infant of a diabetic mom, right? And again, what's the mechanism there? The thing is, insulin actually inhibits the synthesis of surfactant, right? So if the child has, because again, you may be like, why is this child going to have the high insulin? Well, think about it. The blood that's flowing through the placenta, if it has a ton of glucose in it, the thing that's going to happen is the child's pancreatic beta islet cells will be like, we're seeing a lot of glucose. What's going on, right? So those pancreatic beta islet cells, they'll undergo hyperplasia, right? And when they undergo hyperplasia, they'll start making a ton of insulin, right? So that ton of insulin in the child is going to inhibit surfactant production in said child, right? And if you inhibit surfactant production in said child, then the child is going to likely have respiratory distress syndrome, right? So classically on NBM exams, respiratory distress syndrome in a term unit is something you should look for with an infant of a diabetic mom, right? And again, when that child is born, that source of the high glucose, aka mom, is gone. Well, if that source of high glucose, aka mom, is gone, the thing that's going to happen is, it's not like the child's pancreatic beta islet cells that had previously undergone hyperplasia will just shrink immediately. No, right? They will need to undergo like hypoplasia to go back to like their normal levels, right? But again, this is something that happens at the genetic level. It's not going to be done instantaneously within hours, right? So because it's not done instantaneously, the first few days after a child, an infant of a diabetic mom is born, they will have a lot of insulin, but that high glucose source is gone. So what do you think is going to happen to this child? The child's glucose is going to tank. And when the child's glucose tanks, the unfortunate thing that's going to happen is that the child can have hypoglycemia and can have seizures as a result of that. In fact, these kids can also have hypocalcemia, right? So if you see seizures in an infant of a diabetic mom, I want you to think about hypoglycemic seizures or hypocalcemic seizures, right? Because again, insulin drives calcium into cells, right? And insulin again drives glucose into cells, right? So if you see that, you want to kind of keep that at the back of your mind on exams. And if these kids that are infants of diabetic moms have like a heart defect, holosystolic murmur, left lower sternal border, I want you to think about a VSD. VSD is actually pretty common in infants of diabetic moms. So I guess to go ahead and wrap up, quick things I just want to say. Again, don't forget that people that are alcoholics, they can have hypoglycemia, right? In fact, sometimes on NBM exams, they can ask you, what is the mechanism behind hypoglycemia in an alcoholic? Well, again, the thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is, again, when a person has a ton of alcohol, your body is like working overtime to deal with that alcohol problem, right? So the first thing it does is that, remember, alcohol, ethanol in this case, right, will undergo oxidation by alcohol dehydrogenase first to make, what does it form? It's not acetaldehyde. So ethanol, when it's oxidized, I know it forms an aldehyde. I don't know why the aldehyde is just not coming to mind right now. It's definitely not acetaldehyde. What happens at the end? I know at the end you form acetic acid after acetaldehyde dehydrogenase acts on it. I know the aldehyde is ethanol, but ethanol is an old term. It's an old school term. I happen to remember from my days in Nigeria. A 2-carbon aldehyde. I have to do some quick organic chemistry recall here. Wait, I don't know why I'm confused here. So we know that methanol, alcohol dehydrogenase, will make formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is 1 carbon. And then ethanol. Oh, yes, it's forming acetic acid, so it's only acetaldehyde. Okay. Sorry about that. Had to think about that there for a second, or to call someone came real quick there. So when a person consumes a ton of ethanol, right, alcohol, right, ETOH, you form a lot of acetaldehyde. Acetaldehyde is formed after alcohol dehydrogenase works. And then that acetaldehyde, right, can undergo further oxidation to acetic acid, right? Again, under the action of acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. Well, if you look at this, all these things are redox reactions, right? So the alcohol, the ethanol is being converted to acetaldehyde, to acetic acid. So that means as all those oxidations are happening, reductions are happening at the same time, right? The reductions that are happening mean you're making a ton of NADH, right? NADH is the byproduct of those alcohol dehydrogenase and acetaldehyde dehydrogenase reactions. So you may be like, Divine, why is having this high levels of NADH bad? Well, the reason it's bad is that it's going to drive the reaction where you convert pyruvates to lactate. It's literally going to keep driving that reaction, right? Because again, remember, your body normally, right, you know, converts pyruvate to lactate so that you can keep that, you can keep making NADH into NAD, because you need that NAD to keep the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase step of glycolysis going, right? So when you have high levels of NADH, right, you're literally going to keep driving the equilibrium in the direction of lactate. Again, that's actually the mechanism behind alcoholics having like an acidosis, right? That's actually how you ought to know for exams. But again, because of the high NADH, they are favoring the reaction where you go from pyruvate to lactate. Well, think about if you keep making all this lactate and you're driving it away from pyruvate, well, you're going to have a pyruvate deficiency, right? And when you lack pyruvate, well, guess what? You're going to lack like the first agent that's used in gluconeogenesis. Because remember, I believe I talked about this in episode 301. That pyruvate can be converted by pyruvate carboxylase to oxaloacetate. And then that oxaloacetate can be converted by phosphoenol pyruvate carboxykinase or PPCK to phosphoenol pyruvate, right? So basically, you're taking away raw materials for that reaction, right? So that's obviously going to cause a problem, right? So I just want you to keep that at the back of your mind on exams. And again, one thing I will say is for those of you that, you know, need help with the glycogen storage diseases, I do have a podcast on this, right? And then the final thing I want to say is if you see a person that has like certain symptom clusters, especially with endocrine disease, I want you to think about this thing called autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, right? There's this transcription factor, it's called AIRE, A-I-R-E. And one thing it does is when you're, you know, in embryology, it helps you go to the thymus to essentially present your self antigens, right? Including like your endocrine antigens, so that in the future, you don't make autoantibodies or you don't start attacking these endocrine glands / organs, right? So, but if that AIRE gene is mutated, again, A-I-R-E, you will start destroying endocrine organs. And the thing is, there are two types of autoimmune polyglandular syndrome, right? There's a type 1, there's a type 2. The one that involves diabetes is type 2, right? This one actually has autosomal dominant inheritance. And again, this is the one that has those type 1 diabetes genetic susceptibilities, HLA-DR3, HLA-DR4. And again, the triad here, I think of it as person has adrenal insufficiency, right? They have Hashimoto's and they have type 1 diabetes, right? So they have adrenal insufficiency, Hashimoto's, and type 1 diabetes. The type 1, you know, that one is actually autosomal recessive. And this one actually, there's no relationship with like HLA-DR3 or DR4. In fact, this one has no HLA relationship. And again, these people, though, they still have Addison's disease. So Addison's disease is common to both, right? But in type 1, they have like primary hypoparathyroidism, right? So this is actually one of those causes of primary hypoparathyroidism on NBMEs. And then they also have mucocutaneous candidiasis. Now, primary hypoparathyroidism, I really hope you know that there are many causes on exams, right? Again, you can get it from this type 1 autoimmune polyglandular syndrome. You can get it from the George syndrome, right? If your third and fourth pharyngeal pouches don't form, right? You don't form a thymus, you don't form a parathyroid, right? And then another thing you should also keep in mind that causes primary hypoparathyroidism. In fact, the most common cause is very high yield. The most common cause of primary hypoparathyroidism is if you have like thyroid surgery that doesn't work very well, right? So you devascularize the parathyroids or you destroy the parathyroids at the same time and then bye-bye parathyroids, and then person starts seizing after surgery. That's like a classic NBM exam presentation. So I think I'm officially done with this diabetes discussion. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And again, I offer USMLE courses. Again, like in about 2-3 weeks, I am offering a step two CK, step three combined course. It's 20 hours long, over 4 days, 5 hours each day, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time each day. Very high yield course, very comprehensive. You know, we're going to be covering PEDS, surgery, IM, neurology, psych, OB, GYN, neuro. The step one material that your friends at the NBME really love on step two CK. And then those changes from November 2020, biostats, ethics, healthcare systems, professionalisms, communication skills, and things of that nature, right? So again, it's a very high yield, very high level course. People learn a ton. Again, I've had many people take this course that have given me very good feedback, and I've also, you know, actually done pretty well on NBME exams. And then I do have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. So please subscribe. Whenever I make a video, I post it on there. And then I have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify. So you're welcome to subscribe to that. And whenever I make a new podcast, you know, you'll see come up into your podcast feed. Although remember, these podcast apps only let you see the most recent 150. Again, I literally have no control over that. I believe it's either a WordPress or a podcast rule, but basically you can have more than 150 most recent podcasts. If you want everything all the way from episode 1 to episode 303, go on the website, right? It's always going to be on the website. You're going to be able to download the podcast on the website, and you're going to be able to even listen to them straight from the website. And the website is Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S. .com, Divine Intervention Podcast with an S.com. So the quick life lesson I just want to talk about today is the fact that there's a difference between being right and being smart, right? There's a difference between being right and being smart, right? There's a difference between being right and being smart. So the thing is, again, many of you listening to this podcast know that, you know, I'm a man of faith, I'm a Christian. I mean, there's a reason why it's called Divine Intervention Podcast to start. But I feel like many times people, again, okay, let me discuss this, because this is actually kind of a touchy subject. The thing is, if you're doing the right thing, that's good. You should always do the right thing. Doing the right thing is your first priority every time. But one thing you should also keep in mind is try to do the right thing peacefully, right? So say, for example, you know you're right on something. You know it's the right thing to do. Try to get if you are getting disagreement from people, try to still get your point across to them peacefully. I feel like many people these days, just because they want to get their rights, right, they fight people. They do everything, whatever, for it, right? The thing is, again, we're called to be people of peace, not people of war, right? I mean, even there's this part of the Bible that says to follow peace with all men and holiness, right? So holiness means, you know, doing God's will, doing the right thing, right? But again, look at that. It says follow peace with all men. Again, doing the right thing is always your first priority. So there'll be some times where you have to disagree with people because you're doing the right thing, right? Where people say, no, because you're doing this thing, we're going to chastise you. We're going to put you in trouble. We're going to do all these bad things to you because you're doing the right thing. In those cases, then suffer for doing the right thing. That's totally fine. That's a different discussion, right? But the thing is, you can, if, for example, you're trying to show someone that, you know, this is the right way to go, but you do it with love, right? You do it with calmness. You do it with gentleness. Those people will most likely see that good that you're trying to do, right? Because the thing is, many people in life are generally rational, right? They'll say, okay, wow, this person is very respectful about making their points known to us, right? And then when you do those things, right, you end up winning over that person. And the person probably even starts doing the right thing, right? Again, the thing is, one thing many people ignore about this life is people are great copycats. If they see something good, they want to start doing it. That's just the truth, right? People are great copycats, right? So the thing is, model good behavior and model it peacefully. Don't be a person of war. I don't know. I just feel like the current generation we live in, people just really love strife. They really, really love to fight. They really, really love to make their points known, make it known and known very, very loudly, right? No, right? The thing is, you can make a solid, strong point, but you can make it peacefully, right? So do the right thing, but try as much as is humanly possible. Again, as is humanly possible, to follow peace with all men, right? Again, it's not always going to be possible. There will be some times where you have to disobey people because you are doing the right thing. There's nothing wrong with that. Even the Bible says, I'd rather obey God and disobey man. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But again, many times I feel like people always seek out doing the right thing with violence, right? With strife, with war, right? They don't seek out to do those things with peace, right? You should try to do the right thing peacefully, right? You should try to do the right thing peacefully. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, this concludes the diabetes discussion. Again, I can pretty much guarantee, essentially promise you, that for those of you that listen to and understand these three podcast episodes, 301, 302, 303, you'll get a lot of questions right on your exam. That's just the truth of life. Okay, so I'll see you next time in episode 304. Have a wonderful rest of your week. God bless you. Thank you.